Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Good morning. It's Beth, and I'll be reading you today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times dated Monday, April 8th. We start with weather in the lottery, and finally today it's solar eclipse day, and it looks like it's going to be perfect conditions for it. A high of 56 degrees, mostly sunny. Tonight, down to 40 and clear, and Tuesday's looking great too. Another 55 degree day and mostly sunny. Wednesday, a few clouds pop up, a little cooler with a high of 51. Thursday, morning rain, otherwise cloudy. And Friday reaches near 60, but there's some heavy showers in the morning, but with clearing in the afternoon. Taking a look at some of the lottery numbers from the weekend. The numbers game for April 7th, Sunday, midday drawing, 9513. Sunday's evening drawing was 6998. Sunday, April 7th, mass cash, 3, 16, 19, 27, and 32. And Saturday's Powerball numbers, 22, 27, 44, 52, 69, Powerball 9. Here's the first front page story today with the headline, Invest in People and Patients, Hyannis Cancer Center opens next year. The $215 million Peter and Pamela Barbie Patient Care Tower is taking shape on the campus of Cape Cod Hospital and is expected to serve patients in its cancer center by this time next year, said Cape Cod Healthcare President and CEO Michael Loff. The brand new Davenport Mugar Cancer Center will take up the first two floors, with a third floor dedicated to cardiology and fourth floor to medical surgical space, he said. The third and fourth floors will be completed but not opened until a connector is built between the new and existing buildings to allow for access to support services. The new facility will include 36 oncology infusion bays on the first floor and 32 new medical surgical beds on the fourth floor. Cape Cod Healthcare President and CEO Michael Loff said, you'll be able to have your blood work done. You'll be able to ensure that if you need imaging, that'll be done, he said in an interview with the Times. Your oncology drugs will be compounded and provided there. It will be one-stop shopping for cancer treatment. The Barbies donated $10 million from the Edwin Barbie Charitable Trust in October 2021 to the Capital Campaign. Peter, Pamela, and their son Matthew. Direct donations from the trust, which is named after Peter's father. It was the largest donation in Cape Cod Hospital's history. Our goal is to provide and build programs that serve and invest in people and patients so the Cape can be strong, said Luff. Cape Cod Healthcare has seen a 15% increase in the number of patients who receive all their cancer treatment at its facilities. The population of Barnstable County is the oldest in Massachusetts, and it's the third oldest in the country. And the likelihood of someone getting cancer increases the older they get, Loff counted among the reasons behind the bump. He also noted the hospital's partnership with the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative has given people an additional amount of trust, and the hospital's strong physicians, oncologists, and hematologists. We work as a team, said Loff. I think all of those things in concert have led to this big increase in numbers and demand, and we certainly are expanding our cancer care network to meet those issues. Loff said he believes the new facility will require hiring about 40 new workers. He named the housing crisis as a major obstacle when it comes to recruiting. He pointed to a nursing assistant who was working two or three extra shifts per month because her landlord increased her rent and she cannot afford it otherwise. We keep dragging our feet as a community. We need to collectively decide as a community, is housing important to us, and change the approach because it's not working, said Loff. In recent years, Cape Cod Hospital sold a significant portion of its 40-acre Wilkins campus off Attucks Lane in Hyannis to New England Development to create a housing complex. We're going to have to be creative because I don't think the market will ever respond to meet the needs of our community. We're going to have to think a bit differently. As much as I've resisted saying that, I think we're going to have to, said Loff. In other news, a Waltham man was found guilty of 2 counts of rape after a bench trial in Barnstable Superior Court Thursday in connection with the June 2017 sexual assault of a woman in the village of Osterville, according to the Cape and Islands District Attorney Robert Galibois. After his conviction, Anthony Collins, 38, pleaded guilty before Barnstable Superior Court Judge Thomas Perino to 2 counts of indecent assault and battery on a person over the age of 14 in connection with an attack on a second woman. Perino sentenced Collins to 3.5 years to 4.5 years in prison, followed by 3 years probation, according to the DA's office. John Serrallo, Collins' attorney, could not be immediately reached for comment. According to a release from the DA's office, in June 2017, the two women went to a friend's house in Osterville, where Collins was living at the time. The two women had never met him before that night. One of the women, identified in the press release as Victim 1, became intoxicated, and her friends put her to bed. Later, after everyone else had gone to bed, authorities say Collins entered her room without permission and sexually assaulted her. Collins groped the other woman, identified as Victim 2, on 2 separate occasions, the DA's office said. The Cape and Island DA's office said in a statement it would make no further comment. And this story from Chatham: no one likes doing their taxes or paying someone to prepare their tax returns, but the deadline is looming to send one's taxes in by April 16th in Massachusetts. There is a way to get your taxes done without the stress and without paying a dime to preparers who actually enjoy doing them for you. 85 trained volunteer tax preparers are doing federal and state tax returns at 21 sites across the Cape this year and every year. They serve every town from Wareham to Provincetown under the AARP Foundation Tax Aid Program in conjunction with the IRS. Started in 1968 in Florida, the AARP program serves 75 million people nationwide yearly. It's the largest free tax assistance in the country, said Terry Hendricks, who's the local coordinator in the Chatham and Wellfleet tax sites. A half a dozen preparers work every Tuesday and Wednesday for 10 weeks. All preparers are volunteers from every walk of life, he said. Hendricks has an MBA in finances and is retired from Hewlett-Packard. He estimated he has prepared about 120 tax returns this season. Most of the preparers are retirees who go through 5 weeks of training the first year and refresher classes every year after. They must pass 3 IRS exams with an 80% score or better, Hendricks said. The volunteers are also asked to commit to 2 days a week over the 10-week tax season that begins the first week of February, but there can be exceptions. We respect people's time and energy, he said. Mary Jackson of Harwich, who's been an AARP tax preparer for 9 years at the Chatham site that also serves Harwich, said the tests, now all done online, involve a lot of research and problem-solving to unravel the 30,000 pages of the federal tax code. She has put her experience to good use after working for H&R Block for 15 years, on Wall Street as a stockbroker, and doing other brokerage work, all after being a television soap opera actress for many years in New York. I enjoy helping people, Jackson said. I enjoy the mental stimulation. She added that people who come in give us a lot of smiles and many thanks. Richard Nevins, a new resident of Eastham, is in his first year at the Chatham tax site. He says he sees the service as a responsibility. It's not a burden, it's a joy, Nevins said. He also likes feeling part of the community. Nevins had to go through the initial training and pass the test despite having done taxes for clients as a lawyer since 1969. He also taught high school for 20 years. The preparers take pride in their work. We want to make sure there are no errors, Nevins said, noting that the AARP tax preparers have an extremely low reject rate of around 1% with the IRS. Their system involves checking each other's work after each return is completed. The returns are then sent electronically to the federal and state IRS offices. Late Wednesday afternoon, Hendricks was helping Beth Cahoon of Brewster, who had her 2023 taxes done there previously, but returned for an extra check on her previous year's taxes that she had done on her own. She said it had been difficult to do the taxes because of a chronic illness for 21 years and dyslexia, so she was glad to find the free tax service when she recently turned 60 and moved to the Cape. Cahoon was looking for some social activities at senior centers and found the notice online about the tax service. She immediately called for an appointment and was grateful to be put on a waiting list. All sign-ups for the tax service are done through town councils on aging, usually starting in January, and the slots fill up fast. Although most of the tax sites are well booked for the season, Hendricks said, people could try calling in case a place opens up. The AARP tax aid is geared towards seniors and low to middle income people, but Hendricks said, we turn away almost no one. He noted that he prepared the taxes for three generations of one family, from high schoolers to grandparents, as well as a young man who worked at the community center. The service can prepare most returns involving wages, investments, pensions, and other retirement income, Social Security benefits, and self-employment income. Hendricks said the preparers do taxes for many small businesses on the Cape. Hendricks also trains the preparers, and he said he always needs more volunteers. Those interested can contact Hendricks before the fall training at tavolunteerd18@gmail.com. That's tavolunteerd18@gmail.com. And regarding that earthquake that you might have felt on Friday morning, that 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit New Jersey and affected nearby states Friday, leaving people on the East Coast rattled and the ground trembling. The quake was reported around 10:23 a.m., about 5 miles north of White House Station, New Jersey. The quake's epicenter was around 45 miles from New York City, causing New Yorkers to feel furniture and floors shake. People from Norfolk, Virginia to Maine reported feeling the quake. Areas in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts all experienced the ground ripple. An earthquake on the East Coast doesn't happen often, unlike on the West Coast, where California annually gets two or three earthquakes large enough to cause moderate damage to structures, the California Department of Conservation said. Earthquakes are less frequent in the eastern part of the U.S. when compared to the West Coast, but they have occurred in every state east of the Mississippi River, according to the USGS. Some quakes were large enough to cause damage in nearly all eastern states, said the government agency that studies the country's landscape, natural resources, and natural hazards. Since colonial times, people in the New York, Philadelphia, Wilmington urban corridor have felt small earthquakes and suffered damage from infrequent larger ones, according to the USGS. Moderately damaging earthquakes strike somewhere in the urban corridor roughly twice a century, and smaller earthquakes are felt roughly every 2 to 3 years. While not a common occurrence, earthquakes on the East Coast usually cause higher frequency shaking, fast back-and-forth motion, compared to similar events in the West. Faster shaking normally makes shorter structures more susceptible to damage, while slower shaking typically affects taller structures, according to the agency. Many of the older structures in the East, such as buildings and bridges built before the 1970s, were not designed to endure earthquakes and therefore may not fare well, the USGS said. The East Coast is progressing in retrofitting older buildings and constructing modern buildings that abide by newer design standards. On the West Coast, older structures are more frequently retrofitted, and new structures are regularly designed to withstand strong shaking. The Western U.S. experiences more earthquake because it lies along the boundaries of major tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust, the North American plate, and the ocean plates to the west. These plates are moving against each other, breaking up the crust along many faults, like the San Andreas Fault. Faults in the east are less active and lie entirely within the North American plate. Scientists have a harder time assessing earthquakes' frequency and magnitudes on the East Coast due to the geology of the eastern U.S. and the relatively sparse history of earthquakes to study. Eastern earthquakes are more of a mystery because they do not take place at a plate boundary where most other earthquakes originate, the agency said. Scientists do not fully understand the state of stress within tectonic plates, and they are studying how stresses accumulate and evolve and how earthquakes are triggered. Another challenge scientists encounter is locating the active faults on the East Coast. And here is this week's photography column written by Cape Cod Times chief photographer Steve Heaslip entitled Eclipse Monday Has Arrived on the Cape. Leap year 2024 has already given us its extra day, but wait, there's more. Falling squarely between April Fool's Day and Patriot's Day is Solar Eclipse Monday. The total eclipse path passes us well to the north. According to the National Solar Observatory map, Cape Codders can expect to view a partial eclipse with 88% of the sun blocked by the moon's shadow, starting at 2:16 p.m. and the max eclipse at 3:30 p.m., finishing at 4:39 p.m. Stores have been hawking all sorts of eclipse gear, from special 2024 edition eclipse glasses to high-end optics and solar filters for a safe photography and viewing. There will be a lot of photographic firepower aimed skyward at this event. Trying to capture a solar eclipse ring of fire is a great photo challenge, but I have found when the eclipse passes overhead, the best place to aim the camera is not skyward, but downward. Watching people watch the eclipse with their blackout glasses reflecting the sun. When the 2017 partial solar eclipse passed through well to our south on August 21st, I was totally unprepared. That event also arrived on a Monday. Watching from our front deck, we used a cereal box viewer made by one of our neighbor's kids. A visit to the NASA.gov website will give you last-minute directions on this simple creation. It does indeed work, and making photos of people using it provided some interesting photos. The expectations are high for this eclipse, but as always, Mother Nature has the last word on whether the skies are clear or cloudy. Forecasters are giving Cape Cod a high degree of certainty for sun all day. In a rare twist of April weather fate, New England on the cloud probability map looks to have the clearest skies of any on the total eclipse path. So, play hooky, catch some early April sun rays, and a rare astronomical event all in the same afternoon. You might just become an umbraphile, someone who chases eclipse. If so, book early for Greenland or Iceland, Wednesday, August 12th, 2026. In some other news, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump said Saturday he would gladly go to jail in defense of his free speech rights, but appeared to stop well short of crossing the red line set by a New York judge. Trump is under a limited gag order in the so-called New York hush money criminal case that prevents him from speaking out about people involved in the case, including witnesses, jurors, and prosecutors other than the judge. The missives were harsh and personal toward presiding Judge Juan Merchan, Judge Arthur Engoron of the civil fraud case against Trump and his business, as well as federal Judge Lewis Kaplan, who presided over a civil defamation case against Trump, but did not attack witnesses or court staff. If this partisan hack wants to put me in the clink for speaking the open and obvious truth, I will gladly become a modern-day Nelson Mandela. It will be my great honor, Trump wrote in the Post. Biden-Harris, 24, director of Black Media, Jasmine Harris, ripped Trump's comparison to the legendary South African human rights leader on Saturday afternoon. Imagine being so self-centered that you compare yourself to Jesus Christ and Nelson Mandela all within the span of a week. That's Donald Trump for you, Harris said in a statement. The Post preceded by a few hours a Saturday night fundraiser at the Palm Beach, Florida house of billionaire hedge fund guru John Paulson. Trump's campaign said the fundraiser racked in a massive $50.5 million, his biggest fundraiser yet, as the former president seeks to replenish diminished coffers. According to an invitation obtained by USA Today, The attendees included a super wealthy cadre such as Palm Beach County sugar mogul Jose Pepe Fanjul, as well as Palm Beach resident and former Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross. The invitation also lists Howard Lutnick, head of the investment firm Cantor Fitzgerald, mega GOP donors Rebecca and Robert Mercer, Chicago Cubs co-owner Todd Ricketts, investment banker Warren Stevens, and real estate magnate Steve Witkoff. The price of admission on the invitation was $250,000, with a maximum contribution of $814,600, the latter of which the Washington Post reported landed a seat at Trump's table. It was a much-needed boost for Trump, who has been routinely outraised by Biden amid a financial squeeze due to ballooning lawyer fees and legal payouts from his criminal and civil court cases. "People are just wanting change. Rich people want it, poor people want it," said Trump in comments ahead of the fundraiser, flanked by his wife Melania Trump, who has largely stayed away from the campaign trail so far. Some people in the news. The date of Pat Sajak's final Wheel of Fortune episode has been determined. A rep for the show confirmed to USA Today on Friday that June 7th will mark the end of season 41, and the 77-year-old's tenure as host. The TV veteran is filming his farewell episode Friday. Sajak announced last June that after 40 years, this season would be his last. "Well, the time has come," he wrote on X, formerly Twitter, in June of 2023. "I've decided that our 41st season, which begins in September, will be my last. It's been a wonderful ride, and I'll have more to say in the coming months. Many thanks to all of you." This fall, Ryan Seacrest will take the reins as host. He'll be joined by Vanna White, who in September extended her contract with the game show through its 2025-26 season. And Nickelodeon's Double Dare host, Mark Summers, says his appearance on the bombshell Quiet on Set documentary detailing the abuse of child stars was the result of a bait-and-switch. The game show host, during an appearance on the Elvis Duran and the Morning shows, described his interview for the documentary as an ambush. The What Would You Do host said he was called and asked to be part of a documentary about Nickelodeon. Summers, 72, said he didn't know at the time that the documentary was set to be about toxic behavior on the sets of Nickelodeon shows occurring after his stint on Double Dare. He said when producers told him what the documentary was about, he walked out. He goes on to say he was told several weeks ago that he would not appear in the show, but a couple of weeks after that, he was told he was. USA Today has reached out to the documentary's directors and production companies, Maxine Productions, Sony Pictures Television Nonfiction, and Business Insider, for comment. The docuseries was where Drake Bell of Drake and Josh and The Amanda Show first publicly detailed the abuse he suffered from former Nickelodeon dialogue coach Brian Peck when he was 15. Peck was arrested in 2003 and convicted in 2004 for lewd acts with a child from the 2001 incident. And King Charles III is making a royal move that's never been done before, opening the doors to Balmoral Castle. For the first time since the Aberdeenshire, Scotland castle was completed in 1855, guests will be granted behind-the-scenes access to the landmark. Queen Elizabeth II, the United Kingdom's longest reigning monarch, died at the private estate at the age of 96 in September 2022. The residence was where the Queen and her family would spend summer holidays. Tickets for the historic event, with tours scheduled between June 1st and August 4th, sold out this week within a day of being released, according to the BBC. And here's something you might want to take note of. Procter & Gamble has recalled 8.2 million potentially defective bags of laundry pods, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission said Friday, for the severe risk the packaging could pose to children and vulnerable populations. The callback has affected four brands, Tide, Gain, Ace, and Ariel. Up until this time, these particular brands have sold detergent in thin, flexible film bags that can easily be split, the CPSC states in its report. There has been an issue with some outer packaging splitting near the zipper track, Procter & Gamble said, that would make the contents more accessible to children. If a laundry pod or even part of one were to be ingested, it could cause significant injury and even death, Poison Control reports. According to the CPSC, there are no known injuries directly linked to this particular defect and these specific recall bags, though there have been reports of children ingesting liquid laundry packets within this time frame. The following laundry detergent products manufactured between September 2023 and February 24 have been affected by the recall. Ace Pods Clean Breeze and Spring Meadow and Alpine Breeze, Gain Flings Blissful Breeze Scent, Moonlight Breeze Scent, Gain Flings Original, Gain Flings Plus Odor Defense, Plus Ultra Oxy, and Spring Daydream Scent. The Tide Pods, Clean Breeze Scent, Free and Gentle, Light, Original, Oxy, Spring Meadow Scent, Ultra Oxy, Tide Simply Pods Plus Oxy Boost. If you believe you have a recalled product, immediately ensure it is out of reach of children. You can pursue a full refund by contacting the manufacturer, Procter & Gamble. Along with the amount of purchase, consumers will receive a child-resistant bag in which to store the products and a cabinet lock for securing any laundry materials, according to Procter & Gamble. To confirm you have a recalled product in your possession, check the lock code, which is located at the bottom of your laundry detergent bag, to see if it matches any listed at pg.com/bags. Consumers with recalled bags will then submit a photo of their purchased product, clearly showing the lock code to receive their full refund. Stores that sold the recalled products include Big Lots, CVS, Family Dollar, Home Depot, Sam's Club, Target, and Walmart. The products were also sold online on Amazon.com as well as other websites. About 56,000 of the recalled products were sold in Canada, where a recall has also been issued. And this story, the FDA has allowed cell therapies of Johnson & Johnson and Bristol-Myers Squibb to be used for treating patients in the early stages of a type of blood cancer, the company said Friday. Both J&J and Bristol-Myers therapies helped extend the time that patients lived without disease progression in late-stage studies, more than when patients receive standard-of-care treatments. The agency's decision comes after an expert panel backed the use of the therapies. J&J's Carvykti and Bristol-Myers Abecma last month in less severely affected patients with multiple myeloma. Guggenheim analyst Kelsey Goodwin estimated the expanded use would add about 12,000 patients who will be eligible to use Abecma. Goodwin estimated peak U.S. sales of $450 million from Abecma for Bristol-Myers' partner, 270 Bio. Carvykti, on the other hand, could bring in as much as $7.6 billion in global peak sales for J&J and its partner, Legend Biotech. Both drugs belong to a class of treatments known as chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapies that work by modifying white blood cells, known as T-cells, to attack cancer. The current standard of care treatments include use of non-CRT therapies in less severely affected patients. Approved medications for the condition include J&J's Darzalex and generic cancer drugs such as pomalidomide and bortezomib. CAR T therapies have recently come under scrutiny from health regulators. And tribal business owners and entrepreneurs may soon gain more support for accessing services from the Small Business Administration if a bill overwhelmingly approved by the House passes the Senate. The Native American Entrepreneurial Opportunity Act, co-sponsored by Reps Eli Crane from Arizona and Cherise Davids from Kansas, would require the agency to establish an Office of Native American Affairs to support small businesses and entrepreneurs in Indian Country and provide more support to Native Hawaiian organizations. The bill passed the House on a 402-16 vote. A support, A report published by the Federal Reserve shows why Native businesses need the extra support. In 2022, the nation's central bank found that fewer than 1% of business owners are indigenous, although American Indians and Alaska Natives account for about 2% of the U.S. population. In addition to the new SBA office, the bill calls for the agency to develop relationships with tribes and tribal organizations and direct entrepreneurial development, contracting, and capital access programs to tribal communities. The office would also be added to the existing Small Business Act, which requires annual reporting to Congress. So that's our halfway point of our broadcast so far, and now I will read today's obituaries. Kristen Lane Peltonen, 68, of Orleans, passed away unexpectedly on April 2nd. She was born in Fitchburg on the 12th of December, 1955, and brought joy and light to everyone she met. Kristen was a graduate of Fitchburg High School and later UMass Amherst. Her education was a testament to her tenacity, and her life was a testament to her unending passion for the simple joys of life. Kristen was a bit of a free spirit. Following graduation, she spent summers on Cape Cod and winters in St. Croix. She traveled the world, alighting in such places as Costa Rica, Germany, Africa, Greece, and New Guinea, to name a few points of interest. She then settled in the town of Orleans. Kristen's career was deeply rooted in service and creativity. She was an ever-present figure at the Land Ho, a local restaurant where her warmth and charm were as much a part of the menu as the food she served. Later, she worked as a potter at the Plymouth Plantation. Kristen crafted beautiful pieces. Her artistry brought joy and beauty to many homes, and her memory will continue to do so. Kristen leaves her loving brother, Todd Peltonen, along with an extended family of many cousins and friends. She was preceded in death by her parents, Walter and Helen, and her dear friends, Darlene and Tom Green. Kristen's spirit, encapsulated in her vibrant smile and infectious laughter, will live on in the hearts of all who knew her. A memorial service will be held Saturday, April 13th at 11 a.m. at Messiah Lutheran Church on Ringe Road in Fitchburg, followed by a light luncheon. Burial will be private. To leave an online condolence, visit brandonfuneral.com. Back to the news, and this headline, voter dissatisfaction higher among GOP. With many voters unhappy with their choices this election year, a new analysis of Arizona voting data shows Republicans are more disillusioned than Democrats. It could have consequences in the upcoming primary and general elections. In 2020 and 22, voters who generally supported Republican candidates turned away from high-profile candidates who aligned themselves with Donald Trump, as well as Trump himself. Some didn't vote in those races, while others went a step further and voted for their Democratic opponents. That trend is likely to continue in 2024, according to a report from a group of election analysts called the Audit Guys. Growing dissatisfaction and surging disgust add up to a growing problem for national Republicans as Trump and his ideological allies become the face of the GOP, author Larry Moore states in Things Fall Apart, Observations on a Divided Electorate. Moore, along with two partners steeped in data analysis, dubbed themselves the Audit Guys in 2021. That's when they picked apart the methodology the cyber ninjas used to do a review of the ballots cast in Maricopa County's 2020 presidential election. They found the ninjas' work could not be validated or replicated. Now they've turned their attention to voter behavior, analyzing data from the 2020 and 22 elections, as well as the presidential primaries through early March. Moore's takeaway? There's a lot more persuadable voters going into 2024, he said. He reached that conclusion after creating what he called a voter dissatisfaction index, as well as a voter disgust index. The dissatisfaction index shows the movement of voters who support one party's candidates down the ticket, opting against voting for the standard bearer at the top of the ticket. In 2020, the analysis found 6% of Republican-leaning voters did not vote for Donald Trump. In 22, that index increased slightly to 7.1%. More telling was the increase in the disgust index, measuring the proportion of disaffected voters who crossed party lines at the top of the ticket. In 2020, 65% of the disaffected Republican-leaning voters didn't just skip the presidential race. The analysis found they voted for Joe Biden. By 2022, using the same four races cited above, the index jumped to 86%. That resulted in narrow victories for Democratic candidates Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays and healthy five-point margins for Mark Kelly and Adrian Fonts. And some sports news, and whether you follow college basketball or not, it's hard to deny the March Madness that's been ensuing all this last week and culminating today in the final of the men's national championship. But this story is the headline, Is Woman Hoops More Entertaining? In LeBron James' new podcast with J.J. Redick for Basketball Nerds, Mind the Game, James bemoaned men's college basketball in two of the three episodes. It does not translate for me, James said. It frustrates me. My high blood pressure picks up, so I try to stay away from it. James says that having one son, Bronny, who just finished his freshman year at Southern California, and another son, Bryce, who likely will play college basketball. While the men's college game remains popular, particularly during March Madness, a question has popped up, especially among NBA executives who have taken their eyes off scouting men's players to watch the women's tournament. Is women's college basketball more entertaining than the men's game? To James' point, the men's game can be a drag sometime, with coaches micromanaging the shot clock, slowing the game and reducing it to a boring, offensively stagnant affair, sometimes further marred by a grueling procession to the free throw line. They always play the game the right way, passing and cutting and sharing the ball. They're definitely going to get on the floor for loose ball, James said of NCAA women's basketball. But these men's teams, they're doing that as well, too, at the end of the day. But the star power that we have in the women's game outweighs some of the men, too. Certainly, the women's game is enjoying a moment with its stars, from Iowa's Caitlin Clark to LSU's Angel Reese to Southern Cal's Juju Watkins to UConn's Paige Beckers that has captivated basketball fans. The women's game has had moments before, but this is something different and transcends star power. The games, most of the time, are enjoyable to watch because it's a free-flowing game with creative offensive sets and players who can execute those plays. This is not a novel thought. Nearly 30 years ago, John Wooden, the great UCLA men's basketball coach, said, "To me, the best pure basketball I see today is among the better women's teams." And today there is an unprecedented amount of talent in women's college basketball. There's just a lot more shot making than there used to be, Southern Cal women's basketball coach Lindsay Gottlieb told USA Today Sports. I have a friend who 10 years ago would say women's basketball is a game of missed shots and turnovers a lot. So the team that's the best offensive rebounding team might win, or that team that can capitalize. And those times have changed. There's more shot-making in women's basketball, not just hitting open threes, but literally shot creation and shot-making. The talent in shot-making has allowed women's coaches to open up the game and, in some cases, mimic NBA offenses. You have this star power. You have a lot of players right now who can make plays, and coaches are maybe more willing to let them do that, said Gottlieb, who spent 2 years as an assistant in the NBA. The UConn-Illinois men's Elite Eight game was brutal. It was 23-23 late in the first half and 28-23 UConn at halftime. Nearly 50 minutes of real time passed before Illinois scored again, after it fell behind 53-23. Every game is not like that, or Duke's 54-51 victory against Houston in a men's Sweet 16 game. Alabama, for example, is on a sprint to 90 points in every game. Just like every women's game isn't a 94-87 Iowa win against LSU. The Hawkeyes had just 16 points in the fourth quarter of their second-round victory against West Virginia, were 1-for-10 from the field, and 14 of those points came on free throws. Not one thing is all good and the other all bad. But the women's game has free-flowing aspects that don't always include milking the shot clock to under 10, and if the play doesn't result in a good shot, there's not enough time remaining for secondary offense, and it's a helter-skelter scramble to get a shot off, as is the case with too many men's teams. Is the women's game more entertaining than the men's game? Aesthetics are subjective, but the growth and enjoyment in the women's game is undeniable in TV viewership and ticket demand. It's rooted in a style that appeals to basketball fans, and that's a credit to the coaches and, most of all, the players. And just a reminder, the men's national championship final will be held tonight, and it will be Purdue against UConn. Here's today Asks Carolyn column. Someone writes, Dear Carolyn, in 2022, you published my question about not wanting to disclose my diagnosis to my family. It did not have a genetic component, and you and commenters agreed it was fine to stay silent, except to make sure to give my husband the benefit of other support. I had not considered that and was grateful for that advice. Well, now I have an even more significant cancer diagnosis, and this one I've shared because it requires treatment that won't be as easily hidden. And, oh, I'm so glad I have that base of encouraging support from my compassionate husband. So here's my new question. A great many people are being beautifully supportive, and I'm tremendously grateful. I really do not want to get calls, texts, or emails after my surgery. I want to focus on recovering, not socializing. A lot of people assume they are the exception to this because I'd like suggestions for a gracious and loving way to say no, really, to some sincerely caring people with whom I really don't want to interact in the first week after my surgery, even though I love them and they are important to me. I have a caring bridge page, so the basics will be communicated. I don't want to look like I'm blowing off anyone who's been encouraging and supportive, but I imagine a lot of potential texts being generated, and the idea of that exhausts me already. The surgery is a total mastectomy on the side of my dominant hand, so all typing would involve stimulation to the surgical area. Any ideas? Dear Diagnosed Again, I'm sorry about this. I bet people would like to hear from you that they are normally on the You're an Exception shortlist, except this time there are no exceptions given the circumstances, so you'd like X period of time without visits, calls, or texts, use of your arm until you're through the worst of the physical and emotional difficulty of this surgery. And you will welcome them as soon as you feel able, a point at which your husband will notify everyone. Then don't give another thought to how all of this looks. Best wishes for a quick recovery. Some other readers commented saying, there's no law saying you have to answer texts or mail or your phone or anything. In fact, when you do start to feel better, it might be fun to start wading through a flood of texts and answering them at your own pace. Someone else commented, the only thing that needs to be said, and I say needs with hesitation, is I appreciate everyone's love and concern, and I want everyone to know that I'm turning my phone off for at least 1 week after the surgery. So don't be alarmed when I don't respond. The phone is off and in a draw. And here's what to watch today. Monday, April 8th. Now, Eclipse Across America. Pretty much all the networks will be covering this live, starting at 2 p.m. Now, today, at least 32 million people across America will find themselves in the path of a total solar eclipse, the last of its kind that will be seen in the U.S. until 2044. To celebrate this rare moment, this live two-hour special from ABC News and National Geographic offers reports from 10 cities across North America that will be in 100% totality of the eclipse at various times. NBC, starting at 2, will also offer 2 hours of live footage of this rare total eclipse. Tonight on NBC at 8 p.m., it's The Voice. Country star Keith Urban is enlisted as a mega mentor to help prepare the contestants for the knockout rounds. The coaches pair two artists to perform solo against each other, then select a winner to move on to the playoffs. Each coach has one steal. On CBS at 9 p.m. tonight, it's called NCIS Verse, the first 1,000. This one-hour Entertainment Tonight special celebrates 1,000 episodes of the NCIS franchise, including cast members and guest stars sharing favorite memories and behind-the-scenes moments from 20 years' worth of ET interviews. On NBC at 10 p.m., it's Deal or No Deal Island. The island's tranquility is shattered when tensions boil over and personalities clash in the player's pursuit of the largest prize in Deal or No Deal history. And on Independence Lens tonight on PBS, check your local station for the time. It's called Matter of Mind, My Parkinson's. And it's the story of three people who are navigating their lives with determination while living with Parkinson's disease. Again, that's on PBS tonight. Check your local schedule. And some more Trump news. The prosecutor and judge in his classified document case just can't get along. Even when U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon sided with Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith on Thursday and rejected Trump's bid to dismiss the charges for hoarding classified documents, Cannon and Smith seemed at odds. The Trump-appointed judge described a related request from Smith as unprecedented and unjust, and she tartly noted Smith is free to appeal her decisions if he doesn't like them. Smith has threatened to have a federal appeals court review Cannon's proposed jury instructions for the trial for being wrong and too favorable to Trump. The dispute represents at least the fourth conflict between the prosecutor and judge in the high-profile case, with two reversals of Cannon rulings already from the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Legal experts say Smith might have to ask the appeals court to review Cannon's proposed jury instructions because they favored Trump's position in the case. An even more provocative step would be for Smith to try to remove Cannon from the case, a rare move that some legal experts say is justified. Changing judges could postpone the trial until after the November election. Trump faces 40 charges of retaining national defense documents and concealing about 100 records with classified markings at his Mar-a-Lago resort after leaving the White House. He has pleaded not guilty. The latest showdown focuses on the Presidential Records Act, a statute adopted after Watergate that designates nearly all of a president's documents government property to be stored at the National Archives after administration ends. Exceptions are made for personal records, such as birthday cards. Trump contends he converted the classified records to personal documents before leaving the White House in 2021, so any dispute should be handled in civil court under the Presidential Records Act rather than through criminal charges. Trump had previously claimed, without evidence, that the documents discovered at Mar-a-Lago by the FBI were potentially planted there by government agents. Prosecutors say the Presidential Records Act has nothing to do with the case and charged him with 32 counts of willfully retaining and failing to deliver national defense documents in violation of the Espionage Act. Cannon on Thursday refused to dismiss the charges, ruling the charges make no reference to the Presidential Records Act, nor do they rely on that statute for purposes of stating an offense. In this story, an engine cover on a Southwest Airlines Boeing 737-800 fell off on Sunday during takeoff in Denver and struck the wing flap, prompting the FAA to open an investigation. No one was injured, and Southwest Flight 3695 returned safely to Denver International Airport around 8:15 a.m. local time on Sunday and was towed to the gate after losing the engine cowling. The Boeing aircraft bound for Houston Hobby Airport with 135 passengers and six crew members aboard rose to an elevation of about 10,300 feet before returning 25 minutes after takeoff. Passengers arrived in Houston on another Southwest plane about 4 hours behind schedule. Southwest said maintenance teams are reviewing the aircraft. The plane entered service in June 2015. According to FAA records, Boeing referred questions to Southwest. The airline declined to say when the plane's engine had last had maintenance. ABC News aired a video posted on social media platform X of the ripped engine cover flapping in the wind with a torn Southwest logo. Boeing has come under intense criticism since a door plug panel tore off a new Alaska Airlines 737 MAX 9 jet at 16,000 feet on January 5th. In the aftermath of that incident, the FAA grounded the MAX 9 for several weeks, barred Boeing from increasing the MAX production rate, and ordered it to develop a comprehensive plan to address systemic quality control issues within 90 days. Boeing production has fallen below the maximum 38 MAX planes per month the FAA is allowing. The Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into the MAX 9 incident. The 737-800 is in the prior generation of the best-selling 737, known as the 737NG, which is in turn was replaced by the 737 MAX. The FAA is investigating several other recent Southwest Boeing engine issues. A Southwest 737 flight on Thursday aborted takeoff and taxied back to the gate at Lubbock Airport in Texas after the crew reported engine issues. The FAA is also investigating a March 25th Southwest 737 flight that returned to the Austin Airport in Texas after the crew reported a possible engine issue, and a March 22nd Southwest 737-800 flight returned to Fort Lauderdale Airport after the crew reported an engine issue. It is also being reviewed by the FAA. And this headline, cancer vaccine shrinks tumors. Nearly a third of patients with advanced liver cancer who received a personalized vaccine developed by Genos Therapeutics, along with an immunotherapy drug in a small early trial, saw their tumors shrink, researchers reported on Sunday. The result was roughly twice the response typically seen with the immunotherapy alone, the researchers said. Findings from the preliminary study presented at the American Association for Cancer Research in San Diego and published in Nature Medicine suggest that vaccines based on mutations only present in a patient's tumor may boost the immune system's ability to recognize and attack hard-to-treat cancers. The findings, which must be confirmed in a larger trial, moves the industry another step closer to effective cancer vaccines after many past failures, and may expand the types of cancers that such therapies can treat. Partners Moderna and Merck and Company and others have had promising results combining customized vaccines with immunotherapy to prevent skin cancer from returning in patients following surgery. For the study, researchers used samples from patients' tumors to build vaccines based on neoantigens, a new mutations only present on an individual patient's tumor. The goal was to train the immune system to attack and kill only these unique proteins, leaving healthy tissue unscathed. Unlike skin cancer, which has many mutations for the body to recognize, liver cancer is considered a cold cancer because it contains fewer mutations, which has rendered immunotherapies less effective. This vaccine essentially educates the immune system to recognize antigens that it's ignored, said study leader Dr. Mark Yachon of Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. The study involved 36 patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, the most common form of liver cancer. Patients were given custom-made vaccines on top of Merck's widely used immunotherapy Keytruda, the standard of care at the time. Nearly a third of the patients treated with the combination therapy, 30.1%, experienced tumor shrinkage, with three of those subjects having a complete response, meaning no detectable signs of the tumor remaining after a median follow-up of 21.5 months. That compares with the typical response of about 12 to 18% in patients with liver cancer who receive immunotherapy alone. This certainly suggested that the vaccine actually added clinical efficacy, Yohan said. The most common adverse effect was mild injection site reactions, and there were no serious adverse events. Unlike many vaccine candidates based on messenger RNA technology, the Genios treatment is a DNA vaccine in which the genetic code of the mutated proteins is injected into cells using a small electrical impulse. The findings, which must be confirmed in a larger trial, again moves the industry another step closer to effective cancer vaccines. Some news in brief. A man was arrested on Sunday on a charge of starting a fire outside the office of Senator Bernie Sanders in Burlington, Vermont, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the state. Shant Saghamonian, 35, entered the building in downtown Burlington on Friday and headed to Sanders' office on the third floor. He was recorded by security cameras spraying a liquid near the door and setting it alight, the U.S. Attorney's Office said. Sprinklers went off on multiple floors as Sag Hamonian departed via a staircase. There were several people inside the office, but no one was injured, although the door and surrounding areas were damaged by the fire. It was not immediately clear whether Sag Hamonian had a lawyer, and he could not be reached for comment. Sanders is a long-serving independent in the U.S. Senate, representing the northeastern state of Vermont, although in 2016 and 2020 he unsuccessfully sought to become the Democratic Party's presidential nominee. And a ticket sold in Oregon has won Powerball jackpot of more than $1.3 billion, the eighth largest in U.S. history. Powerball drew the numbers early on Sunday, and the winning numbers were white balls 22, 27, 44, 52, 69, and red Powerball 9. The drawing is the 41st since the last Powerball winner hit the jackpot on New Year's Day. The winner matched the correct six double-digit numbers on a $2 ticket. The chances of this happening are 1 in 292 million, which means the top prize rolls over multiple times and the jackpot gets bigger. The lottery drawing, initially set for 11 p.m. on Saturday, was delayed to complete the required procedures before announcing the numbers. The prize of about $1.3 billion can be taken as a single lump sum of about $608.9 million. The other option is an initial payment followed by 29 annual payments. Powerball tickets are sold in 45 states, the District of Columbia, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and in Puerto Rico. And oil prices fell more than a dollar a barrel on Monday, with Brent sliding under $90 as Middle East tensions eased after Israel withdrew more soldiers from southern Gaza and committed to fresh talks on a potential ceasefire in the six-month conflict. Brent crude futures slipped $1.70 or 1.9% to $89.47 a barrel. U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude was at $85.29 a barrel. The world's top oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, raised official selling prices for all crude grades to Asia in May, in line with expectations, after heavy oil supply tightened. Fire struck an offshore platform operated by Mexico's national oil company Pemex on Saturday, killing at least one contractor. This comes after Pemex requested its training unit to cancel up to 436,000 barrels per day of crude exports in April. However, Goldman Sachs analysts expect Brent to stay below $100 a barrel in its base case scenario that assumes already solid demand, no further geopolitical hits to oil supply, and that elevated spare capacity will lead OPEC Plus to raise production in the third quarter. In the United States, oil rigs rose by 2 to 508 last week, while gas rigs fell by 2 to 110. So that's all the time I have for today. This is your reader, Beth, saying thank you for listening, and thank you for your continued support of the Audible Local Ledger.